a useful summary of some important principles involved in decision-making in Catholic moral theology is found in the document from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship, which was originally issued in 2007 and then reissued in 2011 with an additional introductory note. I'd like for us to look together at the introductory note and then at some of the subsections that cover some of the important moral points that I'd like for us to particularly highlight. In the introductory note, if you drop down past the first and second paragraphs to the paragraph that begins Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship, and I've highlighted this text in white, the document points out that it is not intended to be a quantitative listing of issues for equal consideration, but discusses the moral issues and the fact that there are distinctions among moral issues. Some involve opposition to intrinsic evil, and that's a particular point that is emphasized in this document, that there are acts which are intrinsically evil, which can never be justified, and others that require action to pursue justice and promote the common good. This statement will be reiterated in numbers 27 to 29 of this document, particularly in light of what are popularly coming to be called the Catholic culture wars. That is, a conviction of people on one side or another of the political spectrum that they need only concern themselves with moral issues that happen to coincide with their own concerns, their own individual concerns. And so you might have, on the one hand, Catholics who would be primarily concerned with the issue of abortion and beginning of life issues, others who might be particularly emphasizing issues of social justice, such as the death penalty, issues of equality in wages, immigration reform, and so forth. What this document wants to point out is that we need to be united as a church. We cannot have divisions in which either one side or the other claims that the other part of the political spectrum is unimportant or can be neglected. It is true that some issues, as we'll see, involve intrinsic evil, and others involve a much greater spread of methodology in terms of how they should be approached, and are therefore often rather more complex in terms of finding a united approach to dealing with them. But the document attempts to say that we should try to find ways of avoiding this kind of a split while being aware of fundamental moral issues, such as, and if we would drop down to the bulleted sections, two paragraphs down, the bullet beginning, continuing destruction of unborn children, and this is a highlighting of issues that are particularly important, some of which it says involve opposition to intrinsic evils, others involving serious moral questions, noting that this distinction does exist. The first three are of particular importance to us in considering bioethics, i.e. the first one, destruction of unborn children through abortion or other threats to the lives and dignities of those who are vulnerable, sick, or unwanted. That would particularly apply, of course, to euthanasia. And then the second bulleted point, recent efforts to force Catholic ministries, healthcare, education, and social services to violate their consciences or stop serving those in need. And of course, it's the healthcare mandate from the federal government that is particularly behind this statement, the requirement on the part of the federal government that Catholic agencies will need to provide what are referred to as reproductive services, including contraceptives and the provision of abortifacients, that is, agents that cause abortions, and also to provide for health care coverage for sterilizations, all of which, of course, violate Catholic teaching. So that provides an immediate background to this preface to the document, which, of course, was issued before the current crisis in that particular social sphere. And then the third bulleted point, of course, is also very important, the attempts to redefine marriage away from marriage as a permanent, faithful, and fruitful union of one man and one woman, this being a fundamental attack on not just a social structure, but something which is understood by the Church as being a mirror of the love of the Blessed Trinity, as we'll see when we look at the theology of the body of John Paul II. And then under the other bullet points, economic crisis that's devastated lives and livelihoods, including issues of unemployment, poverty, and hunger. The next bullet point, failure to deal with immigration reform and measures that would promote respect for law, protect the rights and dignities of immigrants. And then the last bullet point, wars, terror, and violence that raise questions about the use of force and the human cost of force. So all of these are important issues, and we'll see in the document that although there is a distinction between some of these issues which involve opposition to intrinsically evil acts, all of these are issues that one must be concerned with. Let's drop down to numbers 17 and 18, which are particularly concerned with the question of the formation of conscience. And as we'll see, this is very closely related to the understanding that we've already discussed in the area of natural law. Natural law being the reflection within our own hearts of the divine law, our capacity to perceive God's law, God's will, to perceive moral values, as a result of our being created in God's image. Well, that is reinforced and strengthened by forming our conscience, our awareness of our capacity and power to make decisions. But conscience needs to be formed. Conscience is not simply the question of conviction. What do I believe? What do I genuinely think ought to be done? That's a very important issue as far as the will is concerned, but conscience cannot simply be a matter of conviction. It also has to be a capacity within us which is formed. What are the qualities that form it? Well, that's particularly emphasized in number 18. But let's first look at number 17, definitions of conscience as the voice of God resounding in the human heart, revealing truth, calling us to do what is good and avoiding or shunning what is evil. Conscience requires serious attempts to make sound moral judgments based on the truth of faith. And then a definition from the Catechism, conscience is a judgment of reason, whereby the person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act that they're going to perform, is performing, or has already performed. And then there's the very important point that in all that we say or do, we are obliged to follow faithfully what we know to be just and right. So we are obliged to follow the dictates of conscience, and conscience must be formed. That is, conscience is formed by, and this is number 18, several elements. Number one, a willingness and openness to seek the truth and what is right. Conscience must be open to constantly seeking what is true and what is good. That is, what it is that we should perform, what is right. And how is this accomplished? Number two, by studying sacred scripture. The Bible, the scriptures play an a paralleled and irreplaceable role in informing conscience. Therefore, our participation in the liturgy, our experience of going to Mass, of hearing the word explicated, our other experiences of interacting with the sacred text are part of allowing our conscience, our awareness of what is right and wrong, to be formed in the sight of God. Sacred scripture is to be studied, and we are also to study the teaching of the Church, and particularly emphasized is the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And let me say here very briefly that the Catechism is an unparalleled and vitally important source of teaching for us as Catholics. That we have this is an incomparable grace. We have never had a document as comprehensive as this, based as it is in the documents of Vatican II and subject to the reflection of extremely competent theologians, and indeed sent back to all the dioceses of the world for comment and for editing before it was finally assembled. So it's a tremendous achievement on the part of the Church, and it is universally available on websites. Anyone with a library card has access to the Catechism. So being aware of what the Catechism says and how we can use it in teaching is a very important part of our ongoing project of the new evangelization. So the Catechism is particularly highlighted as a source of which we need to make use. Then number four, forming conscience also involves examining facts and background information about various choices. So again, it's not just a strongly held conviction, but it is a willingness to look at the particular concrete circumstances of a given choice that faces us. And vitally important, number five, prayerful reflection. Conscience is formed, again, if we look at these, by a willingness and an openness to seek truth, by study of the Scriptures, the teachings of the Church, and the Catechism is particularly emphasized, by examining concrete facts, and by prayer, by offering the decision to God and allowing God to speak and listening for the voice of God speaking in their hearts. So if conscience is not formed in this way, then one's conscience is not truly a Catholic conscience. We are obliged to form our conscience according to all of these criteria. Then in Numbers 19 and 20, the virtue of prudence is mentioned. A prudence, of phronesis in Greek, is often translated as practical wisdom. The virtue of wisdom applied to the specific circumstances that require reflection and decision-making. I've highlighted in white, prudence, and this is a citation from the Catechism, enables us to discern our true good in every circumstance and to choose the right means of achieving it. So prudence involves discerning and choosing, and then highlighted in yellow, and I've added numbers 1, 2, and 3 for this, the document mentions that prudence shapes and informs our ability to do three things to number 1, deliberate over alternatives, to consider the various options, then to determine what is most fitting, to determine a course of action, number 3, then to act decisively. And there's the mention in number 20 of the consistently held tradition deriving from the Scriptures and from St. Paul that a good end does not justify an immoral means. We cannot do evil in order that good might result from it. So we are not consequentialists. We believe that actions themselves have an inherent value. And recognizing that, one also needs to acknowledge that the form of response that prudence dictates will be different for different Catholics. There are compelling social problems, and we do differ on how we should respond, but we cannot differ on our moral obligation to respond, to acknowledge that all of these are issues with which we should be concerned. Let's then look at Numbers 21 through 23, and this is the point where it is reiterated that there are acts that are intrinsically evil. Number 22, there are some acts that we must never do, whether as individuals or as a society, always incompatible with the love of God and with neighbor. So deeply flawed that they're always opposed to the authentic good of persons. Our name for this is intrinsically evil acts, and there are three that are particularly highlighted. A prime example is the intentional taking of innocent human life, and the two specific examples that are given are abortion and euthanasia. These are intrinsically evil acts. Nothing can be done either in the circumstances or in terms of the intended goal that would render either abortion or euthanasia good or neutral. They are always acts that are evil in themselves, the intentional taking of innocent human life. And number 23, this would also include as intrinsically evil direct threats to the sanctity and dignity of human life, such as cloning and destructive research on human embryos. This is a kind of a variant on or a corollary of the prohibition of abortion, because it is the creation of human life for the purpose of destroying it for so-called medical research. And then looking back up again, there's a statement that's highlighted in number 22. It's a mistake with grave moral consequences to treat the destruction of innocent human life merely as a matter of individual choice. We do not have the option of regarding or disregarding the intrinsic evil of destroying innocent life. And any legal system that violates this is fundamentally flawed. All right, let's drop down to number 27 to 29. There's an attempt here to avoid two temptations. Having described intrinsically evil acts, there are other acts which, although not intrinsically evil, do promote evil within society and must be opposed. So there are two temptations that one has to avoid. The one is claiming that there is a moral equivalence, that there's no ethical distinction between different kinds of issues or different actions. In other words, this would be someone who would say, well, I don't believe that some acts are intrinsically evil, some things may be wrong, but to label something as intrinsically evil is excessive. It's to give it too much weight as as a negative moral consequence, and to therefore imply that this is somehow an issue that we should be more concerned about than with other issues. One should not opt for a moral equivalence that says all dangerous or bad actions are the same. Some are much more deeply flawed, dangerous, and destructive than others. And that's what the whole notion of intrinsic evil is. Actions that must always be opposed. But there is a second mistake that one can make. And again, obviously, this approaches the question of the culture wars, of divisions within the church on different sides of a political spectrum. And the second mistake is to misuse these moral distinctions as a way of dismissing or ignoring other serious threats to human life and dignity. So if one were to say, I will only expend my efforts opposing intrinsically evil acts, and I will therefore ignore such issues as, and then in number 29, racism, the death penalty, the question of whether a war is unjust, the use of torture, the fact of war crimes, failure to respond to those who are suffering from hunger, or unjust immigration policies. To misuse the category of intrinsic evil as a way of saying these other issues are secondary or can be ignored or are of lesser importance because we must focus our energies exclusively on intrinsic evil is also a mistake. This document says that's a misuse of these necessary moral distinctions. Certainly, one must be aware of the grave consequences of acts that are intrinsically evil, but that should not dull one's conscience to the existence of other forms of evil that must also be opposed. And highlighted in white is the statement, all are serious moral issues that challenge our consciences, not optional concerns that can be dismissed. And the plea is, at the end of number 29, we must not be factions. We must be one family of faith fulfilling the mission of Jesus Christ. Now, obviously, some people will dedicate themselves more primarily to opposing as best they can one issue or another, but it should never be while accusing others of doing a less important job simply because they're working for the restoration of, for example, working on issues connected with unjust war or the use of torture, rather than primarily focusing on, say, the question of euthanasia. The existence of the category of intrinsic evil does not allow us to dismiss as secondary or irrelevant or not meriting as much attention other issues that don't necessarily involve intrinsic evil. Now, the point made in number 30 is also highlighted in this concluding point that we find in numbers 31 to 33, beginning with the insight that a well-formed Christian conscience does not permit one to vote for a program or a law which contradicts the fundamental contents of faith and morals. Now, that seems clear, but in fact, the matter is much more complex. In number 31, exercise of conscience begins with outright opposition to laws or policies that violate human life or weaken its protection. But in number 32, sometimes morally flawed laws already exist, and that is certainly true. In this situation, the process of framing legislation, and in fact the task of legislators, can be extremely complex. And we'll come up against this again when we look at the question of abortion. John Paul II particularly highlighted that you might have a government official who opposes abortion but does not have the power to overturn a pro-abortion law, who is then faced with the alternative of trying to craft legislation that will limit the harm done. So you might have a legislator who would vote for legislation that limits the harm done by abortion, but unless one knows the intention or the direction that this legislator is taking, might make it appear that the person is somehow supporting abortion. John Paul II points out that one must attempt to limit the harm done by such a law, lessening its negative impact as much as possible. That is, choosing the lesser evil. And this document goes on to point out that such incremental improvements in the law are acceptable as steps toward full restoration of justice. However, This is radically different from the situation of a politician who espouses a position that makes no even pretense at supporting church teaching, and, for example, a politician who might support abortion, not attempting to curb it, not in any sense stating that their goal is to attempt to limit harm done, but instead who simply believes that abortion belongs to a category of rights that that individuals have. So that would obviously be completely incompatible with Catholic teaching, and it is a radically different circumstance from the legislator who is doing the best they can in a complex and extremely difficult world where sometimes the only choice that they can make is a choice to limit harm and choose the lesser of several evils. Finally, number 33, a statement of humility on the part of the bishops who have framed this document. The judgments and recommendations we make as bishops on specific issues do not carry the same moral authority as statements of universal moral teachings. So they're reminding people who read this document that it is not pretending to be at the same level of church authority as statements of universal moral teachings that one might find, for example, in the Catechism or in the papal allocutions and documents that we'll be studying dealing with particular questions.